I appreciate your hospitable welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of the conversation that's happening here. My name is Scott Badersay. I teach moral theology at the Seminary of the Southwest in Austin, Texas, which means that I prepare priests and leaders in the Episcopal Church in the United States. The image that you see on the screen is actually a photo that was sent to me by my brother-in-law. And it is it's an image of my recent book, Following Jesus in a Culture of Fear. And he told me that this is what his bedside table looked like one evening. And he thought it was sort of funny. So he took a picture of it and sent it to me. I'm not sure exactly how I was meant to receive his message, but nonetheless, this was an image that captured something. It seems to me it captured at least this. The book asks the question, how does the culture of fear shape us to respond as fearful people? And therefore, how does it shape us, for instance, to need that gun by our bedside? Do we need that gun by our bedside? And perhaps most importantly, what changes in us when we have the gun by our bedside? How does it change the way we react to the world or think about the world around us? As you can see from the title of the book, I came to these questions as a Christian theologian. And so today, I speak to you as someone who has reflected on these things primarily from within my own tradition, but also as someone who believes that there are enough significant overlaps within the Abrahamic traditions, that there are places where I hope my own reflections will resonate with your ways of thinking about and seeing the world and speaking of God. And that we will find places where there are analogies and overlaps in the ways that we respond to a culture of fear. What I'd like to do is to situate the question of Islamophobia within a broader context of how fear gets produced and how fear gets sustained and manipulated. Within North American culture, certainly within United States culture. Because it seems to me that we only fully understand what's happening with Islamophobia if we see the ways in which it is part and parcel of a larger phenomenon in which fear is being used and manipulated politically for economic purposes, and Islamophobia then becomes one instance of the many ways in which fear gets stoked and used by those who have the power to do so. So I want to situate it first by simply looking at the ways in which we produce fear culturally in our societies, and specifically I'll draw some examples from U.S. society here. Some of them, again, may overlap with your own experiences of a culture of fear here in Canada. Let me give you just a few instances. Some of you may have encountered this program. Nancy Grace is someone who has an ongoing show on CNN. She is a reporter of sorts. And you may not be able to read the stories. This was just pulled off of her website. But it says something about the kind of reporting that seems to count as news today. And what you'll notice, if you can read any of those, is that the stories tend to be around sensationalist topics. Murders, abductions, frightening topics, all. And what happens is we have news programs that are geared toward reporting precisely those things that are the most fearful and the most, in some instances, scandalous, because it's what produces viewership. It's what draws people to the screen. And in many ways, this comes to count as news production, even though in many ways it is driven not by the desire to inform us, but by the desire to manipulate us. Here's another clip off of a CNN website, The Future of West Nile Virus. This was a few years back. But it's interesting to think about the ways in which the idea of the super virus continues to come around and sort of get recirculated. There always seems to be a new super virus for us to be afraid of. For a while it was West Nile. There have been many others. But this image to me is especially interesting because not only do you have the fear of West Nile virus and what it can do to you, but just above it you have the advertisement for pre-strike mosquito torpedo. So here's the way to prevent West Nile virus, right? Here's the fear, here's the thing to be afraid of, and then here's the product you can buy in order to avoid this fear. So you see the ways in which marketing and news production work hand in hand, because as we become fearful, we become people ready to purchase whatever is offered to us or buy into whatever campaign is offered to us in order to allay our fears. Another fear that certainly in U.S. news media is hyped and played up is the fear of abduction. Child abductions are often mainstays of U.S. news cycles. This particular clip not only was about abductions, but you'll notice the headline here, Vanished Overseas. Right? So it plays not only into the fear of abduction, but the fear of the other overseas. Right, this dangerous place out there. Unfortunately, certainly within the U.S. news media, what you find is that it is usually young white girls who are the ones most discussed in the news media. Abductions of boys are rarely discussed to the same extent, nor are abductions of people of color discussed to the same extent in the U.S. news media. What they're trying to do here, again, is not simply to say a certain event has happened, but to spin it in such a way that they can draw a maximal audience in order to produce a greater profit for their show. Another way in which the culture of fear sort of amps up our anxiety has to do with health issues. And this is one of them, a headline from Newsweek, "That little freckle could be a time bomb." So the fear now is the fear of our very own bodies. You know, we begin to look at our freckles and wonder if in fact, right, this is something I need to be fearful of. Here's a time bomb on my own skin. Now none of this is to say that that we don't need to be concerned about health matters or safety or anything else, but to say that our reasonable concern for realistic threats is easily magnified and hyped by the media in such a way that what began perhaps as a reasonable concern, right, becomes an all-out fear that begins to control us, that begins to dominate our thinking and acting in the world. I included this. You may not be able to read it very well, but it's a T-shirt from a Christian T-shirt company as a reminder that religious traditions have also, in their own ways, used fear to manipulate. This particular T-shirt says, "Every time you take a breath, seven people go to hell. Don't be one of them." Part of what's humorous, even though it's sort of a sick humor, part of what is sickly humorous about this is that the website says, if you wear these T-shirts, it will provide a great opportunity to talk to people about God. Somehow, I'm not sure anyone's going to approach me wearing this T-shirt and say, I'd like to speak to you about this God of yours. But the point is that within our religious traditions, we have also at times made use of fear. And so we have to be aware, I think for me as a theologian, I want to be aware not simply to point the finger out there at the culture or the media or the politicians, but to be able to also point the finger internally and say, yes, in my own tradition, in my own church, we have at times used fear in ways that were not intended to produce righteousness, but were only intended to manipulate. One of the areas where the culture of fear is especially powerful is around parenting. I don't know if this is true in the same way in Canada, but certainly in the United States, there's a whole industry around creating fearful parents. So when my wife and I had our first child 11 years ago, we were inducted into the culture of parenting fear, which is to say that we were reminded at every turn how dangerous this world is for our children. So, for instance, here's a selection of news stories. Beachbound, try these tips for a safer trip. So you're thinking about vacation. What this tells you to do is, first of all, think about how you can stay safe while you're vacationing. So notice the way that safety becomes the predominant issue. We're getting ready to travel. Be safe is the great concern. Or, for instance, are your kids okay at the playground? A story about the dangers of playing on a playground with your children. The suggestion is that before you let your children play on a playground, you need to actually go through and make sure there are no dangers. I can't really imagine bringing my three young boys to a playground, telling them to sit down while I search the area and make sure it's safe for them. Somehow I don't think they would respond well. But the thing is, we begin to look at all of these spaces that we inhabit and come to think of them as fundamentally threatening. Or this one. Are your children safe in their rooms? So not only going to the beach or going to the playground, now in their very rooms there are threats, and we come to see our own households then as a place of fear, a place of anxiety. Of course, in this instance, the threat they're talking about are the cords that hang down from your shades. But thankfully, they have a product to sell you that will bind up the cords from your shades so that they will no longer be a threat. Again, the way in which parenting fears are so often matched with a product. And this certainly is true with all sorts of products concerned with what we call child-proofing our homes. What's meant by that is, here's a product to cover every corner in your household with a piece of plastic. Here's a product to cover your stove. Here's a product that will, and this is real, here's a product that will lock your toilet so that it can't be opened. Right, so there are products for everything, and they're sold to us by making us afraid of what are, in fact, very, very small threats in our homes. But, of course, we love our children. And it's very easy, then, to prey on the fears of parents, because the suggestion is, if you love your children, you'll keep them safe. And keeping them safe means buying our product. Now, as I was thinking about this and thinking about the context of Canada, I worried a little bit that maybe you don't have the same culture of fear here. I mean, maybe you have escaped some of the sort of anxiety and fear that we face in the United States, the ways that it's sort of manipulated by media and politicians and marketers. But then I started looking at news of your recent election, and discovered that, in fact, it's here too. A couple of headlines I just pulled off of websites. Stephen Harper depicted as a purveyor of fear. Here's a man who profits politically off of creating fear. That's the gist of these articles. But then at the same time, the other side saying, no, in fact, Stephen Harper is the thing we need to fear. Right? So the other side say, fear for Canada, because if this guy gets reelected, we're in trouble. So you see how fear sort of plays, but it can always play from both sides. Everyone wants to use fear to suggest that they are going to be the solution to your worries. I want to take us back just a little bit. I describe this section as a brief modern history of the political uses of fear. Hopefully it's not going to be quite as boring as that title suggests. But I want to take us back a little bit to suggest that this isn't a new thing. The ways in which politics, marketers, news media make use of fear is not something that's come out of the blue in the last 10 years or 20 years or even the last 100 years. In fact, the connection of politics and fear has always been there. Now, it's interesting to note that in the classical world, if we sort of trace ourselves back, at least in the West, prior to the rise of modernity, so say prior to the 16th century and following. We have a way of thinking about politics in which the political involves how we pursue certain goods in common. So we try to name what those goods are, and the question is, how do we pursue them with one another? Because the assumption is that there are some goods that we can all agree on, and therefore we could pursue them together despite any other potential differences we have. Now, this is what political theory looked like prior to modernity. It was certainly not what political practice always looked like. Every ruler and dictator throughout history has known how to use fear in order to wield power. But at least in theory, we thought that something more than fear ought to hold us together. Some sense of pursuing some things in common would drive our politics. What happened with modernity is we came to believe that, in fact, we don't even have enough in common to name the goods that we would like to seek with one another. And therefore, the only thing that links us together is our common fear. Fear became the common element of Western politics in the modern age. So this will be quick, but just to track back where that comes from. If we jump back just briefly to the 17th century, we jump to or the 16th century, Machiavelli, his famous work, The Prince. In The Prince, Machiavelli argues that the way to wield political power is to make people afraid of you. So this is his advice to the rulers of the day, his advice to the prince. If you want to wield political power and get things done, make people fear you. So the idea was we fear the ruler, and therefore we do what he says. And that constitutes political power. Also in the 16th century, a man named Thomas Hobbes is born. Hobbes is English. And Hobbes actually makes this interesting claim. He was born in 1588, and the Spanish Armada was about to attack England. And Hobbes says that when his mother heard that the Armada was coming, she went into early labor with him. And so he says, "Fear and I were born twins." Fear and I were born twins. And what Thomas Hobbes did was to create a political theory, a way of describing what do we mean when we talk about politics? What are we after? He said basically what we're after is a way of controlling our fear. But he thought of it slightly differently from Machiavelli. What Hobbes thought is that really what's at the base of politics is the fact that we all fear each other. That fundamentally it's a war of everyone against everyone, and if we didn't have some sort of political structure, we would simply destroy each other. He believed that politics was based on the idea that human beings are all fundamentally afraid of one another because we all pose a threat to each other. So what he came to think about politics was not that we fear the ruler and therefore we do what he says and the ruler wields power. It was this: we fear each other and therefore we're willing to let the ruler have power in order to constrain the violence among us, right? In order to keep us from having to fear one another so much. So the fear wasn't between us and the ruler. The fear was between all the individual citizens. He thought that was the basis of politics. If we jump ahead just a bit, Michel Foucault was a French philosopher. We're jumping ahead to the 20th century, so thankfully I'm not taking you through a long history, but a brief history. We've already jumped up to the 1960s and 70s. Michel Foucault writes about the use of power within politics. And one of the things Foucault is interested in is the way in which discipline of prisoners shifts over time. So he begins one of his famous books, Discipline and Punish. He begins with a description of a public torture in the 18th century. And he talks about why this used to be normative. And again, right, the model there is Machiavelli's model. If you are afraid of the rulers, then that's what constitutes political power. That's how they wield power over others. And so public torture or public execution was a way to wield that power. Right, a way to show you what could happen. But Foucault says what happens over time, interestingly, is that we shift from that idea that that's what power looks like to something else that's more like what Hobbes was describing, a fear that we have of one another. This image is an image of a prison. And Jeremy Bentham was the one who first imagined this prison. He called it the Panopticon. And the idea was that it's a circular prison, and somebody could stand in the tower in the middle and see all of the prisoners at once. And they would know that they were under constant surveillance. So the goal was no longer to make people afraid directly. The goal was to make people believe that they were constantly being watched. And this was the way to exert political power. It's interesting to note the ways in which we continue to do that, right? The ways we continue to wield power through surveillance. I noticed that in the wake of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, the city now has almost 1,000 video cameras set up around the city, constantly surveying. All right, so this is one of the ways in which we imagine that we are going to keep peace, or that we are going to allay our fears, is by constantly watching one another. But of course, part of what happens when we do that is we just feed the idea that everyone ought to be suspicious of everyone else, right? That we live in a society where everyone you meet on the street is a potential suspect, right? And so they have to be watched. And so what happens then is we begin to form a culture in which we start to treat one another as potential suspects. We become the ones, right? We don't necessarily need the ruler to watch, because we're doing it for him. We'll watch each other, right? We become those who are constantly surveying one another, right? So we have a kind of distortion of the community, but it's based on the idea that fundamentally we need to fear each other. The last person I want to note is a woman named Judith Sklar. She was a Harvard professor for a number of years, but was born in Latvia. She was of a Jewish family, and in the late 1930s, they had to flee. They took the Trans-Siberian Railroad all the way to Japan. From Japan, they made it to the United States, where they were briefly held. From there, they made it up into Canada, where she spent her youth, and then she came down to Harvard to study, and then stayed there as a professor. Her experience of fleeing this threatening environment in Latvia, and the experience of trying to find a place of safety, very much influenced her. And she was a political theorist who then tried to think out, what does it mean for us to try to form a society where we don't have to have that kind of fear? She wrote a very influential article called The Liberalism of Fear. And in that article, what she said is that in the modern world, we can't assume that we have any real agreements about substantive matters. We live in a pluralistic world. We have neighbors who think and believe things that are quite different from ourselves. We can't presume that we're going to find any commonality with them, except for this, she said. The one commonality is that we all are afraid of death. And therefore, she says, we should build a politics based around our common fear of death. And so the political, again, is driven by fear. At the base is a common fear, and then our political question is not how do we seek some good in common, how do we pursue something that will substantively make our lives better. The political question becomes how can we fend off death and suffering. But of course, the problem is then if your politics is based on a common fear in the population, then the politicians are in a strange place. They're in this place. They have to, on the one hand, promise that they are going to take care of our fears, and at the same time, they have to keep us afraid. Because fear is the one thing that pulls us together. So in order to pull together the society, politicians are quite aware that fear does a good job of this, right? Which is why having a common enemy is always helpful for pulling a society or a group together. So they need, on the one hand, to create fear. Even at the same time, they need to be promising us that they are going to get rid of our fear. And so politics finds itself in this impossible place of both producing and then promising to resolve the things that we're afraid of. What I want to suggest is that this is not just a bad idea, but that having a politics and having a marketplace and having media outlets that are fundamentally driven by the production of fear and the assumption of fear in the populace, it's not only a bad idea in terms of our ability to pursue certain things in common, to trust one another, to shape a common life, but there are deep moral consequences of living in that kind of fear day in and day out. And the first of these I call the ethic of security. And by the ethic of security, I mean this. This seems to me a description of what's happened widely within U.S. American politics. Is that instead of thinking about our highest good, the thing we aspire to most as human beings, or as Christians, or Muslims, or Jews, or members of any other religious tradition, instead of thinking about what we aspire to in terms of something substantive, like loving God and loving our neighbor, we begin to think, no, the thing I aspire to most is to be safe. Security takes the top spot. Now, again, traditionally, historically, within religious communities and within many kind of classical political communities, the idea was that there were always some things more important than just keeping ourselves safe. In other words, there were always some things worth dying for. But what's begun to happen within an ethic of security is that we're no longer sure there's something worth dying for. We're no longer sure there's something more important than simply being safe. And when we elevate safety to our highest goal and our highest good, then in a sense, anything goes, as long as I can convince others that it's keeping us safe. And it seems to me that in many ways, this has driven a lot of political decisions within the United States. If it can be described as keeping us safe, it must be morally okay. That's at the heart of the ethic of security. And it seems to me this is one of the basic corruptions that occurs when we allow fear to overdetermine our lives. Now, along with this ethic of security, then, we produce a set of what I call the false virtues. Virtues are basically habits of character. They're traditionally understood as good habits of character that help us pursue the good goals of life and find our happiness and live well with one another. But an ethic of security produces its own version of the virtues, but I call them false virtues because fundamentally they serve our safety, they don't serve our goodness. So the false virtues would include, for instance, suspicion. Whereas many religious traditions would talk about the importance of extending hospitality to the stranger, the ethic of security says you need to be suspicious of the stranger. If you meet someone you don't know, your first concern should be, this person might be a threat to me. And the thing is that suspicion comes to be seen as something that is actually virtuous or in some ways during certain recent periods in U.S. history, comes to be seen as patriotic. Right? It's a matter of patriotism that I begin to look at the strangers in my midst with suspicion. I'm doing my patriotic duty by suspecting those who are different from me, right? And so this comes to be, and if in fact the only thing that's worth pursuing in life is keeping yourself safe, then in fact maybe that's what you need to do, right? Maybe being suspicious of every new person is the way to keep yourself safe. It's probably not the way to create a good society. But this becomes one of the results of this ethic of security. I not long ago, was driving my son to and from summer camp, and there's a billboard along the road that I would see every day after I dropped him off. And the billboard was part of a series of billboards that was plastered all across U.S. highways. And there was a character, McGruff the Crime Dog. And McGruff the Crime Dog would get up on these billboards, and he always had some sort of tip for how to keep yourself safe. And so I'm driving along, and I see McGruff the Crime Dog, and his message on this billboard was this. The message was, when you know your neighbors, the bad guys stand out. When you know your neighbors, the bad guys stand out. Now, my first thought was, oh, well, yeah, that's great, because I like the idea of knowing my neighbors. I like the idea of, you know, community watch, or the sense that we're all sort of watching out for one another. We're in a partnership here, right? I like that idea. So my first reaction was, yeah, I can buy that. And then I drive a little further down the road, and I start thinking, wait a minute. What's the implication of this when you know your neighbors, the bad guys, stand out? There are only two categories here, right? Neighbors and bad guys. Right? There's no category of the stranger to whom I might offer hospitality, the stranger who might actually be a gift to me if I allowed that to happen. That category doesn't exist. And as I thought about it even more, it got worse. Because I thought, wait a minute now. The thing is, I'm never actually going to know all of my neighbors, right? I mean, my neighborhood's kind of spread out a bit. So I know some of my immediate neighbors. But what I might know is that my neighbors sort of look like me. My neighbors tend to be people of a fairly similar class, a fairly similar racial identity. And so if the bad guys are the people who stand out in my neighborhood, it probably means people who aren't like me are the bad guys. What it suggests is that suspicion becomes a virtue within an ethic of security. And what it does is it fundamentally distorts the ways that we relate to people who are different, the people who are strangers, the people to whom, again, many of our religious traditions would command us to give hospitality. But now we are tempted to offer them only suspicion. A second of the false virtues, preemption. Now, we've certainly heard plenty about preemption as a political strategy, as a military strategy, George W. Bush and his doctrine of preemptive war. Preemption as a way of striking out at others who you only imagine might be a future threat. Right? Those who have not actually become a threat. And in a sense, the idea behind preemption is simply this. If my only goal is to stay safe, and if I don't have any other moral goal higher than that, then in fact, striking out at anyone who might potentially be a threat to me in the future does seem to be a way of keeping myself safe if, again, the only thing I care about is my safety or the safety of my group. Preemption then functions politically, it can function militarily, but it can also function in our personal lives. It can function in much smaller ways, ways in which we are afraid to take risks, and so we preempt. We shut something down before it ever gets started. When I was back in school as a teenager, one of the things that would happen is boys and girls would be dating. And then one of them would think, I'm not sure if this is going so well, maybe I should just break up first so the other person doesn't break up with me. Right. So it's a classic model of preemption. I'm going to preempt the pain that might come by simply inflicting some pain on the other person right now. And that way, at least, I'm not going to face this thing that I fear, right? That I will feel the pain of the other person breaking up with me. Preemption is not just on the grand political scale. There are smaller ways in which we let fear preempt our pursuit of certain goods, and therefore we turn preemption into a virtue. And the last of the false virtues I want to mention is accumulation. Accumulation is a way of staving off things that we fear in the future. So as we look toward a future and we think, there are things I worry about. I worry about healthcare. I worry about, what's going to happen when I'm old, who's going to take care of me. I worry about natural disasters. Who knows? Any number of things. If only I can accumulate enough goods and wealth, right, then I can stave off that thing that I fear. So accumulation becomes one of the ways that we try to keep ourselves secure. But of course, again, the problem is that in many of our religious traditions, we are called to be generous with those who are in need. It's a fundamental command to be generous to those in need. And yet, what we are tempted to do by an ethic of security is to assume that better than giving this to someone in need, I should save it so that I protect myself against an uncertain future. So these false virtues all work against what would have traditionally been considered the true virtues within many of our religious traditions, certainly within the Abrahamic traditions. So the question is how all of this sets a kind of background, becomes a backdrop for this specific kind of fear that we're discussing as Islamophobia, a kind of irrational fear of Muslims or the Muslim world in general. And it seems to me that only when we get a sense of how pervasive fear is in general do we then come to understand more fully how this particular kind of fear gets used and distorted politically within that wider context of how we've already become quite good at distorting fear. Distorted fear has two main consequences or takes two main forms. One is that we fear the wrong things. And the other is that we fear the right things, but we fear them too much, right? So on the one hand, I might fear something that's not actually a threat at all, right? But for some reason, I am taught to fear it, I am led to fear it, I am manipulated to fear it, and therefore, I have a fear about something that I really shouldn't be afraid of. The other way in which fear gets distorted, though, is there might be a thing that I should be afraid of to some extent, right? Maybe I should be, to some extent, afraid of a car accident, right? And fearing that to the right extent helps me to be careful when I drive. So that's a good kind of fear if I fear it to the right extent. But when I fear something like that and I let the fear magnify, right, so that it begins to overtake me, it begins to paralyze me, I become afraid of ever getting in a car. I become afraid of the basic means of travel by which we come together and create community. It paralyzes me, right? So there can be ways in which there's a bit of a real fear, and then that gets expanded, and then it over-determines our actions. So what I want to suggest is that Islamophobia becomes a way of distorting fear in both of these directions. Fearing the wrong things. In the case of Islamophobia, fearing Islam as a whole. And I've been in some interesting conversations with my colleagues here over the last evening and morning about the ways in which, certainly in U.S. society, Islam is thought about as a monolithic thing, right? Very little sense of diversity or breadth, in a way that we're quite able to understand that, say, within Christianity, there are lots of different ways in which people have been Christian. And there are lots of different Christian traditions and denominations. Unfortunately, certainly within American culture, there is not that same knowledge of Islam. There's not a sense of either understanding Islam at all, certainly not understanding that there is diversity and variety and multiple voices. And so what tends to happen then is an irrational fear is created around this whole, this kind of monolith that is fundamentally not understood. And yet, because it's not well understood, it's also a fear that's easily manipulated. In terms of fearing the right things too much, what happens then is you have a certain kind of fear created around a kind of picture of Islamic extremism. And that picture then becomes, for many, an over-determining picture, as if this is what we encounter, right? These news stories that depict a certain image of Islam as extremist or violent, these then come to be assumed as the image of what Islam is as a whole. And so we have fear disordered in both of these directions. And what it produces then is exactly the sort of results that I was describing before, right? It's a fear that's not based in reality, but it's a fear that then produces a certain kind of reality of its own. Some of the ways in which as I look at this within my U.S. American context, the ways in which this Islamophobia takes form, mosque controversies, you may have them here. Certainly the Ground Zero Mosque, as it was called, was one of the major mosque controversies. But in the U.S. there have been a number of instances where Muslims are seeking to build a mosque, to gather, and local governmental groups will not allow them to build in a certain area. They'll zone an area in order to exclude. Again, this is one of the results of the irrational fear, a fear that arises largely from misunderstanding, but a misunderstanding that then is used as a political tool. This also shows up in the what's happened recently with the anti-Sharia law legislations that are being pushed in a number of states in the U.S. What's quite fascinating about this is that there are legislators within different states pushing for the states to make a law that says we can make no laws based on Sharia. Now, part of what's interesting here is that they're making a law against something that has not actually ever happened. Right? And for which there is actually, it's not as if all over the place in the United States there is a big push to determine local ordinances or state laws according to Sharia, but in fact, what they do by then passing a law that says we won't do this, what they essentially say is this is a threat that would be coming if we hadn't stopped it first. Right, so it's a basically kind of a preemptive move, but the idea is then they create the very threat that they claim is out there. You create the threat by having to legislate against it, which implies that the threatening thing certainly must have been at our doorstep. Right, so this is one of the tactics of how a culture of fear works. The U.S. hearings on homegrown Islamic terrorism. This is Peter King, a representative from New York. And these hearings went on a few months ago. But again, part of what's problematic here is the fact that the assumption is that Islam as a whole is something we need to be concerned about, right? And so it paints the Muslim community in the United States with a single brush, one that's not actually fair to any Muslim community in the United States. But then, again, by holding hearings on this, it creates the idea that, in fact, this must be a big problem. Right? It's not unlike the anti-Sharia legislation. If we need to hold a hearing about it, it must be bad. Right, so simply by having the hearing, you create a sense in the popular imagination. Again, this is how the culture of fear and the politics of fear work. And lastly, then, unsurprisingly, this produces hate crimes. The Council on American Islamic Relations sends out this email, which I get almost every day, highlighting hate crimes and highlighting areas of our common life that ought to be of concern to us, because these are not things that are generally covered by the major news media. But in fact, this becomes one of the results. If in fact Islam is such a threat, then surely, others say, we need to strike back. Without recognizing the ways in which, to a large extent, the sense of threat is manufactured. Now, one of the interesting things that happens in a culture of fear, then, is that fear produces certain kinds of actions toward the other, toward the stranger, toward those who seem suspicious to us, and that can in turn produce its own backlash, its own reactive fear. This is a Washington Post article, "Hearings on Muslims Trigger Panic." The gist of the article is that these hearings that were going on were at least in the eyes of the author, triggering panic among Muslim communities in the U.S. Again, whether panic was the right word there, I don't know, but in fact, it's a more salacious headline, isn't it? Hearings on Muslims trigger panic. But the basic idea is this. When those who are feared then become an object of hate or persecution, then, of course, naturally, they begin to have their own fears, right? So the fear reacts. The fear comes back. The danger is that a legitimate fear of those who might wish to harm or persecute Muslims can itself also face the problem of becoming an overdetermining fear. Right? Instead of having a reflective response, we have a reactive panic. And this is simply true. The temptation for all human beings is that when we are, when someone strikes against us, that we react, and it tends often to be a panicked reaction rather than a reflective reaction. I noted before that the distortions of fear fell along the lines of fearing the wrong things or fearing the right things too much. In this case, the reactive fear could be tempted to fear that the West as a whole, as a monolith, or Christians or any other group is against Islam or against Muslims. In the same way that some would assume that all of Islam looks the same, it's possible for Muslims to look at Pastor Jones in Florida who wants to burn a Quran and say, that's what Christians think. But of course, that's not what the vast majority of Christians think. The vast majority of Christians think that is reprehensible. But again, what you see is the salacious headline. What you see is something that shocks and provokes because that's what drives news media. And so it's possible that from the other side of the fear of reacting, to assume this is displaying for us what Christians or the West think about Islam. And then, again, fearing the right things too much, being overdetermined and reactive to anti-Islamic sentiment. It's there. It's real. Every time I get the Council on American Islamic Relations email, you see that there are real hate crimes happening. You see that there is real persecution. That's not false, and there's a legitimate reason to fear that. But again, the danger is then taking that legitimate fear and allowing it to overdetermine a response. So I recognize that now I'm sort of speaking from the other side in a way that I don't really, I can't really speak for how Muslims might react to being the targets of fear. But what I am saying is that it seems to me that the ways in which fear distorts us can distort all of us, because we can get caught in a cycle of fear where each of us comes to fear the other even more. And that fear then itself provokes the response of fear. What I want to close with for just the last few minutes is what I'm calling a theology of fear, which is simply to say this. What I've tried to do so far is to really describe fear, how it works in culture, how it gets produced, manipulated, how it produces certain kinds of distortions to our moral character, distorts us into being people who do not actually hold to our highest ideals or live them, but who get seduced by a promise of security. But I want to suggest that underneath that is a basic, deep, human issue that really we get at best by thinking theologically. And so here I want to think within the realm of the Abrahamic traditions by going back to sin and fear in the garden, in Eden, in paradise, in that time before Adam and Eve make their journey to earth and make their journey out of the garden. You may well remember the story of Adam and Eve in paradise. It's a story that exists in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scriptures, a story in which Adam and Eve eat of a forbidden tree, and after eating of the forbidden tree, they hide themselves, right? They cover up their bodies, and then there's an expulsion or a sending off. In the Christian and Jewish narratives, ascending out of Eden, in the Quranic narrative, ascending from paradise to earth. But there's a kind of a movement out of paradise that occurs at the end of this story. And what's interesting is the way in which the events of that story describe for us something about what is basic to human fear and the ways in which it is and always has been a problem for us as human beings. Simone Weil said this once in her description of the eating of the forbidden tree. She said, "It may be that vice, depravity, and crime are nearly always, or even perhaps always, in their essence, attempts to eat beauty, to eat what we should only look at. Eve began it, at least in the Jewish and Christian narratives. If she caused humanity to be lost by eating the fruit, the opposite attitude, looking at the fruit without eating it, should be what is required to save it." Weil gives us a really sort of interesting take on this story, the idea being that as we gaze upon this tree that human beings are forbidden to eat from, that what we see in that is something that is tempting because it's beautiful. But the problem is not that it's beautiful. The problem is that we grasp, take, and consume what is beautiful, right? And in so doing, we destroy the beautiful. And what Weil suggests is that part of what we have to do is to figure out how to gaze upon and let the beautiful be in such a way that we don't need to possess it. We don't need to take it, and in our taking of it, destroy it. So with that as a background, then, we move to the place where the man and the woman have eaten of the tree. And what happens in the Genesis account, the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord. In Surah 7:22, they began to cover themselves with the leaves of paradise. We have a situation where hiding begins. Hiding begins in the face of disobedience. The human beings begin by hiding from each other. And then, in the Christian narrative at least, they also then hide from God. When God shows up, they hide because they're afraid. And it seems to me part of what this says about human fear is this, right? Because I take these episodes of hiding as having something to do with being afraid. We hide because we're afraid of something. Fear has entered the story here. And so human beings hide from each other. The original man and woman hide from each other because they are no longer sure that they are secure in the presence of one another. They hide from one another because, having already transgressed the command of God, how do they know that the other will not continue to transgress the command? Or, to put it in Simone Weil's terms, having already eaten the beauty of the tree, right? How do I know that the other will not seek to consume my beauty, right? That I will simply become an object to be consumed by the other. So the human beings hide from one another because we're not sure we can trust each other. We then, at least in the Christian narrative in Genesis, we hide when God enters the picture. In the Genesis story, God has said, if you eat of this tree, you will die. So when God comes then into the narrative, what the human beings think is death has arrived, right? The punishment is here. And so they hide themselves perhaps not initially or primarily from God, but they're hiding from death. They see death coming upon them. And so they hide. They feel fear and they hide. What we see then is that this process of hiding, this result of fearfulness, a fearfulness that has come because human beings have shown themselves willing to transgress the commands of God, and now we live in what feels like a very unstable world, this fear then produces the distortions of our lives that come into play as we are exiled from paradise. And so what I want to suggest in terms of a theology of fear is that in this story, we see in some ways a summation of all of our fears, of all human fear, which is this, that they return in one way or another to the fear of death or the fear of the other. And here's what's interesting in the Genesis account. When God calls the man and the woman to accountability, each of them blames someone else. Adam blames Eve. Eve blames the serpent. And what's interesting here, right, remember that the promised result of this transgression was death. Each of them becomes willing to hand someone else over to death. It wasn't my fault. It was Eve's fault. It was the serpent's fault. So not only do we have the basic fear of the other and the fear of death, but a willingness to sacrifice the other in order to keep ourselves safe. Right? And all of this is sort of compactly displayed in this story, that for human beings, the great danger is that we come to fear the other, we fear death, and therefore we're willing to sacrifice the other in order to keep ourselves safe. And this then gets replayed time after time after time in human history. The good news, since I don't want to leave you on something quite that depressing, the good news is that within the Abrahamic traditions, as we narrate what happens after this story, we narrate the possibility of overcoming fear. God gives us a path beyond fear. From Surah 238, we said, "Get down, all of you, from this place. Then whenever there comes to you guidance from me, and whoever follows my guidance, there shall be no fear on them, nor shall they grieve." God provides a path that leads us away from fear. In the Jewish scriptures in 1 Chronicles, "You will prosper if you are careful to observe the statutes and the ordinances that the Lord commanded Moses for Israel. Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid or dismayed. If you follow these statutes, here's a path laid out for you. You do not need to be afraid." And in the Christian scriptures, in Luke 12, Jesus says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Do not be afraid." And in 1 John, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear." In each of these traditions, there is hope that as we walk in the ways of God, as we move more deeply into the reality of God in our own lives, we also move beyond fear. We move beyond the ways that fear determines us and the ways that fear distorts us. I'll close with this brief story. Yale theologian Miroslav Volf recently wrote a book entitled "Allah, A Christian Response." And in it, he describes a moment when he is walking with a friend through Sarajevo. He is at a conference on building bridges between Christians and Muslims. And he's at this conference, and he's talking to a friend as they walk through Sarajevo, this place of great and tragic history in terms of the violence that's been perpetuated there. And as they walked through, his friend said to him, "The only way beyond our current turmoil is to reclaim the fear of God." And Wolf said it was quite interesting to him to think about what that phrase meant, what it meant to reclaim the fear of God. Because as I've just displayed in these Abrahamic traditions, there's a sense that following the path of God is a way beyond fear. And yet it is also quite clear in these traditions that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And that the fear of God may also be the beginning of political wisdom. But the fear of God here, interestingly, works differently from our fear of things in this world, right? We fear things in this world because we see them as evil objects that threaten something that is good. And so, of course, we're afraid. But God is not an evil object that threatens something that is good, right? It's actually working in the reverse when we talk about the fear of God. God is the good one who threatens all of the ways that we might take refuge in sin or unrighteousness, that we might become participants in evil. The fear of the Lord is the way in which God's goodness passes judgment on the ways that we fall short of that goodness. And so what Miroslav Volf's friend was saying is that it's only going to be as we reclaim some sense that we stand together under a God who calls us to righteousness, a God who calls us to justice and love and goodness. Only as we reclaim that common sense are we going to find a real path to peace. And in that way, then, we come to learn that we do not need to fear each other. We do not need to fear each other. but that it is precisely our failure to love each other and to love God above all things that leaves us in this place where fear can distort and disorder our lives. Thank you.